I am Zane Lamprey. This is the Zane Lamprey Show. I am right now, as you're listening to this, out on the road someplace in the world, in the country, I don't know, doing stand-up. Come join me and your friends for a night of stand-up comedy, great beer, fun stories, good times. Go to ZaneLamprey.com, get your tickets. So my guest today is Maz Jobroni. If you don't know the name, you know the face. If you don't know the face, you probably don't know the name. Does that make sense? You would know Maz from a lot of movies and guest star appearances on TV shows. Also, as a regular on Superior Donuts with Judd Hirsch, a funny show. So he is a stand-up comic, and he has two specials out right now. One is called Immigrant on Netflix. We go watch it right now. I'm sure you have Netflix. And then on Peacock, you may have Peacock, NBC's streaming network, he has a show called Pandemic Warrior. Both very funny. I've watched both. Pandemic Warrior was filmed in Dubai right before the pandemic. So we talk about that. We talk about his Iranian upbringing, moving to the U.S. when he was six, and his journey into comedy and then into adulthood and then into an age that we currently both are residing at. I'm talking about that age bullshit. So listen to the interview. Maz is a very funny, smart, interesting guy. This is a great interview with Maz Jobroni.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. The Zane
Lamprey Show. Yeah, so for me, it's like I think about my age every day.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I kind of, and if maybe I'm preparing for this, like I kind of think of myself as being 50, even though that's a next year thing. Yeah. But maybe that'll make the
day. Do you
want to
talk about this on the show?
We are. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Oh, good.
I'm sorry.
I wasn't sure. Okay, good. Yeah. Good. I wasn't sure. Okay. Yeah.
Go sorry. On. I pressed record.
I was like, this is good stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I see. Well, now I'm going to start over.
No.
Okay.
No, keep going.
All right. Well, good. So, well, I'm going to start over just so you know, like, that we're on.
No, I don't mind.
We're fine.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Totally.
So.
Wait, are we starting now? No, I'm kidding.
Let's schedule this for Tuesday.
I only work when I hear action.
Yes, sorry, so, action.
No, thank you very much.
Mr. Jobroni, you're on.
Did
Go.
They tell you I'm a movie star?
They did.
Thank you.
They
Go
did.
Ahead.
They yes. said to make sure that you said, and don't, which is interesting in an interview, to not look you in the eye and sit
not
facing away from you.
Yes, exactly.
It's fine. Yeah, I'm fine.
And I needed a crew, but
I'm
you
fine
need
with that.
Bring
oh, and
crew.
You, can you please look towards me? It's a little awkward.
Have you heard about that? Like, I think they said, I think it was Clint Eastwood, they say, like, he doesn't say action. He's just like, he's like act or
yeah
or some
kind of begin or something like that.
Something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
To like lower the
or just like okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
But I did say that.
Yeah,
you didn't
yeah.
know that I
yeah, right,
I'm
right.
I am very similar to, yeah. to Clint Eastwood.
You are the Clint Eastwood.
But like in your are you the same way? Does your age like pop into your brain once a day?
All the time because I think also the world we live in, you know, couple of things. First of all, I don't even know if there is a profession where people are only categorized by age. I mean, like, is there an office?
You mean besides ours?
Well, no.
Besides entertainers?
No. What I'm saying is we come across young people all the time.
Yeah.
Now, if you were, I don't know, a doctor, you're still going to come across young people. There isn't a profession where they go, it's except maybe the Congress, where they're all a bunch of old people.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I think that because we come across young people, whether it's as performers, fellow performers, or audience members, we're reminded of our age all the time.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
You know, I remember one time I was at the Laugh Factory and I made a reference to Marlon Brando, and the younger people in the audience were just staring at me, and I was like, Marlon Brando, one of the greatest actors of the 20th.
Like, if there's one person in that place that didn't know, you should just have him leave.
Well, the guy didn't know. And
didn't, hadn't like heard of
they
him?
They hadn't heard of Marlon. And then I said The Godfather, and they were kind of like, oh, yeah, that guy. Like, that guy.
Yeah.
And then it's funny because
okay.
Then I was doing a book talk later at a university, and the teacher was a couple years younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, because somebody asked the question, they go, what's it like performing in different parts of the world?
Right.
Is there a cultural disconnect? I said, as a matter of fact, a lot of the material I do in the U.S. translates over there because you're talking about your family or whatever, it works.
Right.
But I said, the bigger disconnect is generational. And I mentioned the whole Marlon Brando thing. And then the professor who was around my age was like, oh, people don't know who Marlon Brando is? I go, I don't know, let's ask your students.
Yeah.
I said, who here knows Marlon Brando? Like, one hand went up.
No, stop
I
it.
I swear to God.
The Island of Dr. Moreau?
I'm telling you.
That's the worst movie.
So here's the thing I realized. I said, the difference is when we were younger, there was, what, three networks or four networks. So we were watching the old generation. I watched Leave It to Beaver, even though it was 20 years.
Because there wasn't enough content.
Yeah. Now, you go through your life not watching television. Like, we don't even know each other's shows. Mm-hmm. We don't even know each other's mediums. Like, you could be a big, you know, Snapchat person, and all your stars are Snapchat people, mm-hmm. and my stars are who Hollywood tells me my stars are. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. so that reminds me of my age all the time when I'm talking to people, and I'm going, "Oh God, that's just like the fact that there's so much out there, right?
Yeah, right, right, right."
But the generational thing and the age thing is always a reminder. I mean, you're being reminded all the time. I went to some frozen yogurt place. I was getting frozen yogurt. This girl's like, you're that comedian, right? I go, yeah. She goes, yeah, my parents love you. And I'm like, oh God.
Oh, here we go.
I go, come on, woman.
But that's the thing too, is back when there were three channels on, you pretty much knew everyone on the three channels because there wasn't a lot of people to know.
Yeah.
Now it's like, you know, your special's on the Peacock. There is still NBC. There's all these different OTTs and things to get.
Also, I think when we were kids, old people felt old.
They did.
We feel like in our minds, we think we're younger at least. And we are relatively, we don't dress older. I don't have a briefcase. Right. Back in the day, at 40, they had a briefcase and they were angry all the time.
Do you remember Wilford Brimley in Cocoon?
Yes.
And he was like 50.
Yeah.
And he, in my mind, still he feels like 65.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was just, maybe he was just older. But another thing you just brought up is okay, so I have my apparel company.
Yeah.
And we just hired someone, a female, and I'm saying that for a specific reason, who is 37 years old.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, we just hired this girl. Well, I mean, a woman, I don't know.
Yeah,
is it a girl or a woman? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Because like, and then I had my old business managers who had a secretary, whatever, and he's like, oh, my girl handled that for you.
Right.
And I was like, oh, was that ever okay?
Yeah, yeah.
It was like
there's
some madman shit
right
there.
Yeah.
But in your mind, how old do you feel if you had to put a number on it?
I mean, I probably feel earlier 40s in my mind. My body reminds me that I'm later 40s. Yeah. I still, 50 feels like, wow, half a century, really?
Yeah.
That in my mind, earlier 40s. Like if I get an audition that says early 40s or 40s, I'm like, I could do that.
Yeah.
This is 30s. I'm like, you're pushing it.
Yeah.
I go, you're really pushing
it.
Well,
we have to do a quick little dye job.
And that's the other thing with like, I've dyed the beard before and it's fine. It feels a little younger, but then it just goes away and then you're like, oh, what a pain in the ass. I got to keep doing that.
I know. I was doing it. My wife said she likes it. And I was just like, now I can see myself in the mirror. And it's just like, so I have a beard and it gets gray on the side and it gets a little gray here on the chin.
Yeah.
And I'll see if I can tell this succinctly. Hopefully this is not too long of a story because this is about you. And then we're gonna turn everything about
great.
You.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And so I went to China with a buddy of mine.
Uh-huh.
And my buddy is a year and a half younger than me.
Uh-huh.
But he's a CrossFit guy. And we were going there to like maybe develop some products in China. So we just went there for a week to this big expo. And he was at that time, his name's Dan Wells. At that time, he was on the cover of Men's Fitness.
Okay.
With his shirt off, looking great, whatever. And I said, bring that magazine. So when we show these people we're making an exercise product, like show them you're on the cover of this magazine.
Yeah.
So we get there and it's called the Canton Fair in Guangzhou, the Canton province. And if you picture a football field full of like all different vendors, it's 40 of those.
Wow.
Like there's not enough time to even go through all
of them.
So we met a woman in like the food court area who is a translator and can help us, you know, navigate it, whatever. So we hire her.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, here's the deal. We're making this product, this exercise product. And her English seemed great. Passable, decent at this point.
Right.
And so this is my friend Dan. So he's on this magazine and I have an apparel brand, but we're doing this we're trying to get this product to going together, this athletic product, whatever. And she's like, okay, I got it. So we go around, we're pitching all these different vendors and stuff, and she's showing them the like it would be racist if I did like an impression of her in a Chinese accent, like in Chinese explaining.
Sure.
It would be racist?
No, I don't know. Go
like if
for
I was
it.
Like, because I'm like, we're standing back. She's like, oh, I'm done.
You don't know what she's saying, basically.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But is that a thing?
I don't think so, because you're not necessarily like you're not, you're saying what you heard, right? So
yeah.
You're not making fun of her. You're not making a funny face or anything right now. You're saying this is what it sounds like to
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Still probably a little bit racist.
Yeah, probably.
So anyway, she's doing this, whatever. So everything's all set. Then we're back home and we're like, okay, we found a few people that we were going to work with, whatever. And she's like, and I was doing like a Zoom with her or something like that. And she's like, oh, is your son here? My son. Yeah, the you were with.
Hilarious.
Wait, what do you mean? Who you were with? Your son. I'm like, who do you think is my son?
That's
Dan.
Funny.
I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, yeah. She's like, you have an apparel company that does very well. And so you launched a magazine to put your son on the cover so you could help your son with his
Hilarious.
Career.
I'm
like,
love it.
Wow.
I love
and so
it.
That's what she told everyone.
That's fantastic.
So here I am with like
so
a great...
So you're a media mogul because you launched a magazine.
I don't care about that. I'm the father
it,
of
no,
my
you're
friend.
Looking at it the wrong way. You are now... The you are the
a media magnet.
You're a media
the
magnet.
The Larry Flint of the
Larry Flint. If you want to go there, I was thinking more. What's the guy? The
Hearst.
The Australian guy. The right wing. The guy who owns Fox.
My pillow.
My pillow guy.
sure, Zane. You're the my pillow.
No,
guy.
What's his name? Murdoch.
Murdoch.
You're
yeah,
the
Rupert Murdoch.
Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
In her mind, she's mm-hmm. like, that is...
Who
that,
has a very unsuccessful
so,
son.
And then when you go and you play it in your head again, you're like, wait a minute, I did hear her say, well, you are, Rupert Murdoch.
Yes, exactly. Right.
I heard
exactly.
Murdoch.
Well, for me, I was like, okay, I'm going to go lose 20 pounds and shave my beard because
yeah.
I can't be my friend's father.
Dude, I think we do what we can, which is, like you said, you know, try and stay relatively fit.
Mm-hmm.
I like to drink, but it's sometimes when I look at some people who drink a lot,
yeah.
And the guy's like, "Yeah, I'm, you know, 52," and I'm like, "3 years old."
Well, you go back to like, you go back home or wherever. So you moved here when you were six.
Six, yeah.
And then where did you live?
Northern California.
Northern California.
Yeah.
And so when you go back home, sometimes there's people your age. You're like, "Whoa, bro, you kind of, you gotta pick it up a little bit."
It's sad. It makes you sad because it reminds you you're getting older. But it's sad to see those people getting older and unhealthy.
Do you remember living in Iran?
Very little. I was a kid, so I remember like playing. We had a big house. I remember playing in the yard, and it was very Western influenced back then. So I remember like Muhammad Ali was big because he was the world champ at the time, early 70s, mid 70s. And being a Muslim, I think people in the Muslim world loved him. So we would see his fights. My dad was a big fight fan, so we'd see that. I had a bunch of Muhammad Ali dolls. I remember being a fan of Spider-Man. I had Spider-Man, you know, comic books. I remember seeing Rocky when I was in Iran.
I wonder if like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar also transcended.
Probably
because of
that. He might have. Yeah, he might have. Yeah, those are names that probably did. And also back then, again, going back to this idea of everybody knew that person because it was boxing was like the greatest thing.
Yeah,
basketball. You know, I'm sure people knew of the name at least, right?
But now, but boxing, individual sport at that time. Bigger than the UFC is
bigger.
Now.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you who the champs are in the UFC.
Yeah,
but everybody knew Muhammad Ali.
Yeah,
So yeah, those were the influences back then in Iran.
Yeah,
it was like I said, it was very Western influenced, but there was also, you know, certain things of Iran that it was a good life. My father was a successful businessman, so he had an electric company, so we had a big house.
Why the move?
Because of there was a revolution. Uh-huh. So the revolution starts happening in late 78, I think, protests start happening. In the 78, protests start happening in the streets of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And the revolution officially happens in early 79 when the Shah leaves and Ayatollah Khomeini comes.
Mm-hmm.
But we had left by late 78. So my father was with
a lot of people.
People were starting to flee. So my father was on business in New York in the late 78. And I think people in Iran felt that the Shah would quash the protests and be able to, you know, bring back order. And, and there wasn't, nobody saw the revolution happening.
Right.
So my dad told my mom, hey, listen, I'm here. And my sister and I were on our 2 week, we were on our winter break from school. So he's like, why don't you come bring the, you know, me and my sister, and you guys can go back in a couple weeks. And I always say we packed for 2 weeks and we stayed for 40 whatever years because right. we didn't go
did
back.
Did he... Oh, so he really did think there was a potential that you'd return.
I think everybody thought there was a potential they'd return. What's interesting, if you ever get a chance, if you go on YouTube, put you could put Iran hostage crisis Ted Koppel.
Uh-huh.
There's all these shows from the late 70s, early 80s of Nightline. Nightline became Nightline because of the Iran hostage crisis.
Right.
So what happened was the show was being called America Held Hostage Iran Crisis or something like that.
Right.
And like day 142, they started calling it Nightline. And there's on YouTube, Ted Koppel going, you know, we were going to start calling this Nightline from now on.
Oh,
but
wow.
But we're still focusing on the Iran crisis, blah, blah, blah. And he's sitting there in front of a typewriter and then people yeah. would come on a screen. He would talk to them. And it's crazy because I'm watching that and it hit me for the first time watching it. I go, gosh, my parents must have been watching this every night thinking, when is the news going to come that...
I mean, it's like COVID in a way.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
I told my wife, I said, imagine if you thought COVID was going to end in a year, but it mm-hmm. didn't end for 40 years.
Right.
And you kept watching because people kept thinking, oh, we're going to go back. We're going to go back. And then a lot of people couldn't go back.
Did they lose their house then?
My father had a lot of property and stuff back in Iran that he left. And then he was able to get money out because he was doing business with American companies
yeah.
at the time. So we came to America. He had a lot of money. He bought some properties in Marin, turned around, sold them, was doing well. And then the recession of the early 80s hit. So he started bleeding money because, mm-hmm. you know, and losing money that way. And then he ended up, like, by the late 80s, early 90s, he'd kind of lost all of his money. And at that point, it had been 10 years since the revolution. And the government said, listen, because we had a lot of money and there was a brain drain that left at the revolution. So
right.
the Iranian government said, look, if you're...
Meaning that, like, a lot of smart people...
Doctors, yeah. businessmen, whatever, took off and left. Because if you had been successful under the Shah, a lot of them were then being persecuted. And the country went from what was more Western or open-minded mm-hmm. to a religious, you know...
Zealots and...
Yeah, basically a theocracy.
Right, right.
And it became very dark very fast. They started executing people that were part of the Shah's regime. So there was like public executions and all kinds of crazy stuff. And then
wow.
that led quickly into a war with Iraq because Saddam saw the potential to go in and take the oil on the border of Iran and Iraq.
Right.
And then Khomeini thought, oh no... Look, we succeeded in having the Islamic Revolution happen, so we will now spread our Islamic Revolution and fight the Iraqis. So then they go into war with each other, and some, you know, several million people die at that war.
Mm-hmm.
So it was dark in Iran, but
yeah.
but after the 10 years, I think the Iranian government realized, oh my God, we lost a lot of people that left. So then they got the message out saying, look, if you fled the country during the revolution, but you weren't like you know, cousins with the Shah or really, you know,
got
right-hand
it.
Man,
yeah.
come back. So my dad went back, and at that point he had all these properties he'd left behind for 10 years, and he went back to try and do things with those properties, but then was told, look, you owe all these back taxes
oh,
for
God.
The whatever. Yeah, so so then he was kind of stuck trying to find partners that had money that could pay the back taxes so they could take the property and turn it into something.
Wow.
So it was really a... It was a you know, shock to the system. You know, somebody mm-hmm. recently I was talking to this person who's an Iranian American analyst, and he said, you know, a lot of the people in the diaspora, he said, and people there, they go, we live with PTSD.
Right.
You know, when you hear these people like fleeing Syria, for example, because there's a civil war, you hear the stuff going on in, you know, Palestine with the, you know, Israelis and the Palestinians. You know, imagine you're living in a home and then all of a sudden it's destroyed. Well, that causes trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like somebody saying, oh, we're moving from Culver City to Westwood.
Right.
We're in a home and it gets, you know, bombed. Or you're in your country and all of a sudden the government flips. Imagine if the insurrection had succeeded.
Yeah.
And they had said, you know, in their mind, they continue to believe that the election was a fraud. So imagine if the insurrection had succeeded and they had actually, you know, executed Nancy Pelosi.
Or Pence.
And Pence.
Yeah.
And Trump had continued to say, see, that's what I'm talking about. we are the rightful winners of this election. And not only that, but now I'm going to deploy the military to make sure that nobody, you know, and by the way, I'm going to nullify all the Democrats in Congress because they don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know,
it right. could,
and
right.
it went that way. Well, you know, your whole world is flipped upside down. And then now you're forced to flee this country and go live in a country you don't speak the language. I'm going to go to Argentina and live.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am, a successful, you know, whatever, lawyer or whatever I am in this country. And I go over there. I don't know the legal system. I don't know anything. I don't know the language.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to go work at a gas station.
Right.
That happened to these people.
Right.
You know, so. Yeah.
And as you're six and you're kind of thinking of it as a vacation.
Absolutely. Right? As a kid, for me, it was like, oh, this is cool. Like, I don't have to go to school.
Yeah.
And my father, by the way, being a successful businessman, he was staying at the Plaza Hotel in New York, which was across the street from FAO Schwartz, biggest toy store in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I found out, by the way, that it was one of the coldest winters in New York in a long time. It was 78, winter of 78. So my dad would, whatever, have meetings by day, and it was me, my sister, and my mom going around, you know, go to Macy's and, you know.
Like living at the Plaza for a while?
Living at the Plaza, ordering, you know, I remember discovering strawberries with whipped cream. That was like our thing. We order strawberries or sometimes with strawberry sundae. You know, now my kids have sweet tooth and I sympathize with them because my sister and I, that's all we do. We're sitting in a hotel room in Iran. Maybe cartoons were on for like, you know, a half an hour or an hour a day.
The third Monday of every other month.
Exactly. Yeah. In America, it's like 5 hour.
Yeah.
You go from Popeye to Woody Woodpecker to Bugs Bunny to Leave It to Beaver, whatever. I was like, oh my God, this is the best. So yeah, for me, it was an extended vacation.
You know what kids don't have now is Saturday morning cartoons.
Oh my God, it was the best.
The significance of waking up early. By the way, not too early because they started, like if you wake up too early, you had to watch some like weird local stuff.
Yeah.
And then cartoons, that's when we got them.
Yeah,
and then shortly after that, it was just like after school, and then it was an explosion.
I remember, I think it was like Empire Strikes Back or something, because sometimes I gotta go back and look at like IMDb to find out when these movies came out.
Right.
Because I go, Star Wars, I think, came out in 77, I think, so I wasn't here yet. But Empire Strikes Back came when I was here,
mm-hmm.
and I remember waking up that morning when it was coming out and watching the Saturday morning cartoons. I was up at whatever, 7 or 8, knowing that my parents were going to drop me and some friends off at like noon to go watch the matinee. And it's so exciting. I'm like, oh, what a day this is going to be. You know, popcorn, you know, Empire Strikes Back, you know, probably on the way back, maybe pick up some action figures. You know, I mean, it was just like, what a world, what a life.
I know. It's funny if you think about, so, you know, like Back to the Future was 1985 and they went back to 1955.
Yes.
And it was like, wow, everything's so different. And I actually started during the pandemic. So my stand-up is mostly about my, like, drinking. Not necessarily me going out and getting drunk or whatever, but like going to different countries and different drinking customs. And kind of the weirdest stuff that happened was when the cameras weren't rolling.
Right.
But during the pandemic, I got asked to do a corporate Christmas party virtual, which is like, you know, awesome. it's great money, but it's a tough, tough thing.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, by the way, you know, most of the company is Mormon, so maybe don't do your drinking jokes.
Oh gosh.
So I had to write. Like a
Mormon
whole,
jokes.
I just was like, wow, I'm going to treat this as an exercise. I'm going to write some like new stuff.
Take my wives, please.
Yeah, take my wives. Exactly. And so I started doing this like, I just like kind of free flow writing. And I just had this joke that kind of dissipated. Because I was talking about how in Back to the Future, 1985, you went back to 1955 and whoa, everything's so crazy.
Yeah.
And then... But if we went back 30 years, it wouldn't even be 1985.
Yeah.
And I was like, and how similar things are. And then I started like dissecting it and like, no, they're not. No, they're not. You know, people just iPhone, computer, just everything at your fingertips, you know?
Well, it's crazy because I have been asked to do, so I went to UC Berkeley undergrad. So a few years back, I'd done stuff for them. And then a few years back, they go, listen, we have our incoming freshmen. And part of our welcome week, would you do stand up for them?
Uh-huh.
And I was like, sure. So they got me and Sammy Obaid, who was another alum, and we'd do our shows. And the first time I went, this was like maybe 3-4 years ago, I did the math, similar to what you said, because I was like, it's not just when I graduate. I graduated college in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
I got into college in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going, 1989. I did the math, and it was about 30 years later. So that would mean I'd be sitting there, and there'd be a guy from 1959.
That's, yeah.
Blew my mind. Right. And I was like, wait a minute. I'd be sitting here going, who is this old fart? I don't relate to him at all. So that was my worry when I went on stage. But I was like,
old people were old people back then.
They were old people, because what happened for me was, it actually ended up being kind of cool, because I do a lot of material about like my parents and like, you know, how I struggled with my immigrant parents and they didn't want this, they didn't want that. So these kids, me complaining about my parents, they related in complaining about their parents.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
And then also I realized, I just did another one the other day. And again, I thought, God, really, these college gigs are like, they should get someone in their 20s. Why are they getting me 49? But I did a lot of material about COVID. And it relate, and mm-hmm. they related. So it's interesting having that challenge of, like you said, whether it's Mormons that don't drink,
mm-hmm.
or people that are, you know, 30 years younger
yeah.
than you,
yeah.
and finding like, how do I get the key to this audience?
You know what? It's occurring to me now, and I may be wrong because this is not even well thought out, but it's like, I wonder if that generational gap, because of the information age that we're in, has broadened. So a 20-year-old isn't that different from a 50-year-old now as much as it was.
Maybe you're right. Yeah, yeah. Then, because you're right.
For whatever reason.
Because when you say Snapchat, I know what that means. When
right.
you say TikTok, I know what. I might have even just done a TikTok video.
Yeah.
That said, there's still like moments where my daughter, who's 10. I'll be getting ready to post a story on my Instagram, and she'll be like, can I see that phone for a second? I go, sure. And she just like pimps my ride.
You yeah.
know, she adds colors and this and yeah. that, and it's nothing that I even thought about.
Right.
And she just does it second nature. And so I know that I'm a little bit of a dinosaur, but I also know that I can still relate. And you're right, because back then, you know, whatever, they're listening to Perry Como records, and they, you know, you have to go listen to your record.
I had my dad was, this is, it's so cliche, but my dad was like, turn off that noise. You know, like that was like
yeah.
said so much, like, yeah. you know, and by the way, it was like, I don't know, like Van Halen, which yeah. is now, kids would be like, that, what is that?
Dude, you want to feel
classical?
Old, watch any music awards show and you'll feel old, because they're like, you know, the best album, it goes to mm-hmm. Smakululu. And you're like, who's Smakululu? And you yeah. don't know Smakululu?
Oh, now.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It's the worst.
Yeah, because I was at Disneyland 2 days ago and Mel was like, oh, that's so-and-so. And I was like, who's that? And it was a guy with an entourage. And she's like, he's a famous rapper. I'm like, ugh. By the way, I know his music. I just didn't know him.
Didn't know him. And then
you know
they
I mean?
Do. And then they did like... you know, a Lifetime Achievement Award for, I forget who it was. It was like younger than Mary J. Blige.
Oh, no.
It
oh,
was
no.
like
a
someone.
A Lifetime Achievement for someone that.
Yeah, right. Someone who I, in my mind, I was like, wait a minute, I'm older than.
Yeah.
It was like Lifetime Achievement Award for, I don't know who it was. It was somebody like Salt from Salt and Pepper, whatever it was, whoever
yeah.
it was. I'm going, oh my God.
It's like, yeah, don't give me a Lifetime Achievement Award until I'm done.
They gotta be 90. Like,
yeah.
they gotta be 90. Like,
yeah.
not younger, not 44.
When you went to UCLA for your PhD,
yeah,
what did you study?
So I got my whole journey was a little detoured because my parents were typical immigrant parents, lawyer, doctor, engineer.
You will be
thing.
More than us because you have all these opportunities.
Yeah, and we have a name in the community, and you should do this and do that. And mm-hmm. at the age of 12, like at 10, I fell in love with Eddie Murphy. Wanted to be like Eddie Murphy. Mm-hmm. At the age of 12, I was doing plays. In school musicals, and every time we do a show, the director would tell my parents, he's got what it takes, like your kid like is good at this,
mm-hmm.
and they'd be like, okay. And then we get in the car and they'd be like, that bitch is crazy.
Yeah, right. Doing that.
So going into college, it was like, just be a lawyer. So I studied poli sci, thinking I'm gonna be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Then my junior year, I go to Italy to study abroad. There's a professor, I love what he does, and I think, okay, that's what I'll do. I'll just be a professor.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a good compromise between lawyer to please my parents and comedian, which is what I want to do. So I got into the PhD program at UCLA to get my PhD to become a professor in political science.
Ah.
But what happened was I went and auditioned for the the big play they were doing there in the theater department.
Ah.
While I was there, I was like, let me try this. And really, if you're a serious PhD student, you're spending your time getting
PhD
ready to,
stuff.
Not running off and rehearsing.
Yes, exactly.
So what would happen is at nighttime, I'd be at rehearsals and be like, I love this world. And then by daytime, I'd be in classes and our conversations would always be, well, what's our purpose as political scientists? And they were like, publish or perish. So it wasn't so much teaching, but rather come up with a theory that explains something, write a book about it, and go to conferences around the world and defend your theory. So I was like, I don't want to do that.
Right.
So I dropped out the first year. I did two plays. I did the fall play, and I was ready to get out. And then this director who was directing the spring play was like, hey, I'd love for you to be in my spring play. So I was like, all right, I'll just hang out and go to poli sci classes so I can do that second play.
So you paying tuition to do the play?
I paid tuition to do the play. Here's how stupid I was back then, because the tuition back then was $8,000. That's not much at all.
Wow, no, that's great.
So in my mind, I'm like, okay, I'm taking an $8,000 loan out.
Yeah.
But first of all, I always thought, oh, I'll make the money back and pay it off. But more importantly, I was like, you know, they give us this student ID card that gets us $2 off movies in Westwood.
Mm-hmm.
So if I see 4,000 movies, I'll break even.
Your math checks out.
That was my plan.
Yeah. How are you doing? Have you caught up there?
I think I saw three movies.
That is a very cool school to go to. Just a cool campus and a cool vibe.
Well, you say, well, I like Berkeley better than UCLA. UCLA, similar to Los Angeles at the time, Los Angeles has gotten a little bit better, but it was very decentralized.
Yeah.
So there was some activity here, some activity there.
But it's not like centralized. It doesn't revolve around Westwood, really, or
a little bit. It didn't have that. Like Cal, you show up at noon at Sproul Plaza, which is the main plaza. It was packed, and there was crazy people screaming about like Jews for Jesus, and then there was a homeless guy.
Did you go there when the naked guy was there?
Yes, I was there when the naked guy was there.
So that was a guy who went to class and everywhere completely naked.
Yeah. So what happened with that guy was?
So you saw his penis?
Yes. There was a nudist movement that was happening. So and it was like the hippies around Berkeley.
Yeah, it's Berkeley. Yeah.
Always hairy. Always like, I was like, why do the most unattractive people gotta be?
You go to a nudist beach, you're like, no.
Can't you guys recruit a few hot people? This is just not cool.
Yeah, or skip a meal.
Skip a meal. So that was them. So then this guy was actually a good-looking young dude. He was a student. He joined them. And so he would show up once in a while. And I remember one time walking back to like from campus to my apartment, whatever, and I look back. He's like a few steps behind me walking like with a – he had a toga thing around his waist. And I don't remember if his penis was coming out of it. I don't remember that part. I just remember, I was like, oh, that's the naked dude. And I heard late years, so he got some popularity. He supposedly posed, I think, in Playgirl magazine.
Oh my god!
And then I think he either committed suicide or died or something. That's what I heard.
Oh,
so it was interesting. I don't know what his MO was.
I thought it was obviously anti-establishment, but also it was like. It was showing that it was like, it wasn't illegal because there was like things that like whatever. And I don't know if it's because around an educational institution or whatever it was, but.
It was a movement. You know, I think, obviously students are very motivated. Obviously, you go to any protest, it's mostly students, right? So he found his cause and that was his thing. And
I look pretty good, but I'm not wearing clothes. So I think
he's good looking. I think he, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of girls were like, oh yeah. Like they were into it, you know?
Oh, so.
It was a good stunt.
Oh my god! Well, we're talking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we're going to talk about Pandemic Worry. Where first of all, the titles of your specials, Axis of Evil comedy special.
Yeah.
Which I remember. That was 2007.
Yes.
Brown and Friendly.
Yes.
I Come in Peace.
Yes.
I'm Not a Terrorist, but I play one on TV.
Yeah.
Immigrant.
Yeah.
Which is currently on Netflix.
Netflix.
And then your new one, which is on Peacock, NBC's. Yeah. Network channel thing. What do you call that?
Streaming network.
Yeah. Pandemic Warrior, which you shot in Dubai.
Dubai, yes.
Right before the pandemic?
Yeah, so in 2019, I was doing a tour in the Middle East, decided to shoot the special in Dubai, and then come back, and I was like, oh, I'll edit this, sell it somewhere. And...
Did you pay to shoot that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I've paid to shoot... Let me see which ones. I paid to shoot I Come in Peace... I paid to shoot, I'm Not a Terrorist, but I played one on TV, and I paid to shoot Pandemic Warrior. Those three I paid to shoot and then sold them.
Great.
And I will do it with emphasis every time.
She's like, no, you didn't. And Mel slammed the door and left. Liars!
So this one as well. I was in the region. I said, let me just shoot it. And
meaning, shoot it, meaning, for people don't understand, you used your money, hired your own crew.
Yeah, yeah.
A director?
I directed it, or yeah. Co-directed. I mean,
someone that was out there calling.
I've learned now because what happens is, you know, the only one I had where the guy had a truck and he was calling the shots as he was going.
Yeah,
was the one I Come in Peace, mm-hmm. in Sweden, and the guy, the production team we found, the guy goes, "You want me to bring my truck and call it as we go?" And we're like, "How much?" And it was not that much. We're like, "Yeah, bring the truck."
Yeah,
because we go, at least we end up starting with a full edit, like,
right,
a, you know.
right.
So there's a few things I've learned. One was my brother-in-law, of all people, who's a comedy fan, he pointed out to me years ago a Bill Burr special where he was standing in front of a curtain and just doing it, and he said, I really love this special because there's not that many audience cutaways, so it feels like I'm in the room, mm-hmm. watching, and mm-hmm. they're kind of like medium shots,
mm-hmm.
So I go, oh, that's interesting. So I started watching specials with that in mind, because if you give it to an editor, a lot of times editors go, oh, go to the audience, come back, go to right. the... Only go to the audience when you need to cut between... because usually, as you know, we film two shows.
Yep.
And then you take the best show, then you edit in any fixes you got to fix.
Yep.
And so one thing was, I realized, okay, we're going to stick with as much of me as possible, and we're going to stick with as much as medium shots of me as possible. So people watching at home feel like they're part of the audience. So mm-hmm. that's pretty simple. So then you just tell this guy, whoever you get to shoot it, you go, I need four cameras, yep. one wide, one close up, one medium, and one on the audience.
Yeah.
And just give me those four. And it's been pretty simple. And so I've always been, except for Immigrant, which was paid for by Netflix, mm-hmm. where then I had a director on board.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, they gave me a real budget.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I can pay someone to come direct this.
Yeah.
And even then, he gives me his cut, and I look at it, I go, guys, there's way too many audience shots. I don't need to see the audience that much. So we filmed it in Dubai with the intention of coming back and selling it in early 2020. Pandemic hits, and then I see some specials that come out under the lockdown.
Yeah.
And it felt like they'd been shot on Mars, because there was an audience together, there was no masks. The comic was talking about getting stuck in traffic, or there was no traffic at the time. So I was like, oh gosh, you know, I was like, let's keep trying to sell the special. But if we sell the special, I said, I want to do a few minutes that we edit into the top where I'm performing.
Oh yeah.
At home.
Right.
Into the camera. Yeah. And just putting in perspective.
Right.
So the special starts with me in this tiny little room going, hey, I shot this in Dubai, but now I'm shooting it in my closet because that's what's going on. And I do some jokes about being under the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Now let's go watch what I shot. And then at the very end, I come back and I do some more closet comedy, I call it.
Yeah.
You know?
Your engagement with the audience is great. Now, keep in mind, I'm performing in front of, in a brewery,
yeah.
in front of drunk people.
Yeah.
You probably had less drunk people, significantly less at yours. And so it felt so safe when you engaged with the people and, you know, like finding out who is, you know, who was from there and kind of having those dialogues. And so, I mean, How did that has to, obviously that's different in every time you do it.
I tend to do that all the time. I did that in Immigrant as well, and I don't know when I picked it up, but I started doing that, and it became part of my shtick, you could say now, where I go into the audience and I find a few people, and you know, hey, what's your name, Eugene? Where are you from? Blah 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 blah, and I have like four or five people. Then throughout the show, I go back to them. It helps me connect with that audience. That audience feels like, oh, this is a unique show to us, even if some of the jokes might be jokes I've done before.
Right.
They feel like it's new. And sometimes that presents something different that you weren't expecting.
Yeah.
Like in this case, for example, in the Pandemic Warrior, any Americans here? One guy claps. Oh, what's your name? Abdullah. You're an American named Abdullah. Where? I live in North Carolina. Really?
Yeah.
So that was like, great, because then for me, I'm going to riff anyway, and if it works, great, I'll throw it into the special. If it doesn't, then I just cut it out.
Right,
right.
So how long was that performance?
You mean how time-wise?
Yeah, yeah.
I do about like an hour and 15, hour and 20 or something, and I look at it, I go, that's going to be, you know, I remember when I did the Netflix one, they told me, they go, look, you don't want to come in more than an hour 10.
Right.
simply because people lose interest. And yeah. I was like, you know what? It's interesting because I was watching Chappelle's, which I was really enjoying, but 45 minutes in, I was like, oh, how much longer is this going to be? Mm-hmm. So I go, if Chappelle, if I'm at Chappelle's and I'm getting tired, people are definitely get tired of mine. Yeah. So like, let's just try and, you know, edit it down a little bit. Now, when I went back and added the pandemic bit, it ended up being, I think the special now is like an hour and I don't know, 12, 13 or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think what if you remind yourself that you can fail during the taping because you're going to have a second taping.
Yeah.
Or if you're going to do one taping, you definitely should go long because then you'll have stuff to cut out.
Yeah, you need to have stuff to cut out.
Yeah.
What does Habibi mean?
Habibi is like a term of endearment. It's like saying my friend, my love, my buddy.
In what language?
In Arabic. So okay. I picked that up over there. So you're got like it. Habibi, like, you know, it's like a term. And then for women, you would say Habibti. Like parents say to their kids.
Yeah.
You say to somebody like, hey, dear. You know.
I liked it.
Yeah, it's cool. yeah. And also, like I said, like, you know, crowds I've come to see appreciate you doing that. It can't get out of control. I just went back to Dubai to do a show for the comedy festival.
Oh, when were you there?
Just last week.
Wow.
Yeah, and there.
What's the pandemic status?
They're very well vaccinated. They're mm-hmm. still wearing masks. They don't have the crazy people that we do where like there's protests against the mask and stuff because you get in trouble.
Yeah, you can't punch a flight attendant for asking you to put a mask on.
Exactly.
Okay.
So they don't have that. Yeah. So they abide by the rules. But the show was such that, I do my crowd work, and the stage was set up in a way where it was this like arena, and to go to the bathroom, you have to walk past the front of the stage, at least the people in the front area.
Right.
So they started doing it. And I couldn't help but I have to acknowledge it.
Yes.
And then people kept doing it.
Yeah.
And they kept doing it. And then it became it for me it was fine for the show, but after the show I got feedback. Some people were like, oh, I love the crowd work. It was great. You know, you making fun of those people. A couple of people hit me up, they're like, I had a horrible time at your show because it kept getting interrupted, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, gosh, there's nothing I can do.
No, that's the show.
Yeah.
You have to understand it's the whole thing.
Yeah.
You can't if you just power through it and don't acknowledge it, then how is it unique to that situation?
Yeah.
If you're a comedian and you ignore things that are happening, like when Mel left and she closed the door to her, like if you don't acknowledge that, then people are like, is he calling this in?
Yeah.
So you went. I mean, your special was filmed in Dubai.
Yeah,
and you just went back there. Did you go back there a bunch?
Yeah. So when we did Access to Evil in 2007, we went there for the first time, and I toured there. We did a big tour in the Middle East, and it was like 27 shows in 30 days, sold out.
You did you did 27 tour dates?
27 tour dates in 30 days in the Middle East between Dubai.
Wow.
Which is UAE, so mm-hmm. United Arab Emirates. So we did Dubai, we did Jordan, we did Lebanon, Egypt, and Kuwait.
Wow.
So, you know, some cities like
Lebanon. And what were the venues?
Lebanon, they have a casino called Casino du Liban.
Okay.
Because it's in French. They speak French, English, and Arabic there.
Yeah.
And that's 1,000-seater. So the promoter was like, yeah, when we bought the tour, like when we, you know, subcontracted it, we bought one night and we sold out like that. So we bought a second night, sold out. They ended up doing 5 nights in Lebanon. Did like a week in Dubai, followed by a big outdoor amphitheater to close it.
Wow.
So what happened was, because at the time there hadn't been comedians from the US who went to the Middle East to perform for the people of the Middle East.
Right.
Usually they would
especially with relatable content.
Especially from that background.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, there's a double whammy because there'd never been a group of Middle Eastern American comedians on American television.
Mm-hmm.
I always say, like, it was me, Ahmed Ahmed, Aaron Kader, Dino Bedal. Like, it was the first time you had four Middle Eastern or Muslim comedians or performers on television. We didn't get killed. It was that's progress.
That's right.
So we come out, we create some buzz here by doing that. We get a lot of press around it. This is still during the Bush era, Iraq War, Dick Cheney, waterboarding, Al Qaeda, all that shit's still mm-hmm. there. So we, you know, like I said, press-wise, we were New York Times, we were, you know, Time Magazine, Hustler, you name it, we were getting coverage. So it did pretty well here, but at that point, YouTube was just starting to take off, so our clips were getting passed around. Mm-hmm. So I was on email lists of people passing my clip around. They didn't know I was part of the email list, I was on it.
Wow.
I go, people are getting to know me. So eventually this gets known in the Middle East. And then there's a cable network there at the time called Showtime Arabia. They buy it. They air it. That helps promote us there. So when we land, I felt like we became the Beatles over the Atlantic. So we get there and they go, oh, there's going to be a press conference for you guys. I go, who's coming to our press conference? And we show up and there's like 30 news outlets, including American news outlets. And, oh, there's a tour of Middle Eastern comedians performing in the Middle East. So it just gets huge. And then at that point, by the way, comedy is new to them.
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah, so they knew of, you know, some comedians and stuff. But people, again, people hadn't been going to perform for them. So all of a sudden, all these big companies are like, oh, we have an event coming up. Why don't you come perform at that? So we started coming and going a lot. So it became a thing where right off the bat, like we couldn't, there was not enough, like we were getting offers left and right. Come perform at this corporate, because they'd seen us at the big show. And so, yeah, I started going back and forth to Dubai a lot. And then it became like, so for me, it became, because comedy really is worldwide now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I go to the Scandinavian countries. Anywhere where they speak English, you're good. So I go to the Scandinavian countries and I'll do like, you know, Norway, Sweden, you know, I'll go do Holland, which isn't, you know, a Scandinavian country, but still it's there. London, and like I'll do like whatever, 7-8 in several cities in these countries. So I would do, so my tour routine had become like, you know, Middle East maybe every year and a half,
mm-hmm.
you know, Europe every year and a half, Australia every year and a half, and then the cities in the US. And that gives me enough time to come up with a new act, so the next time I'm back, they're not hearing the same stuff.
Where are you
stuff.
Coming up with your new material when you're on? Because you're always touring.
Yeah, I'm always touring, but when I'm home, I'm at the factory in the store.
Got it, working on it. So you're still out doing your current stuff while you're here working out your new stuff?
Pretty much. I mean, it's like on the tour, you're working out, you know, you sometimes you'll work out some new bits as well. And then when you're home, like over the, like what I was lucky enough where the tours were successful enough so that I would tour, let's say, from late January to early, let's say, June. And then the summer would be off. But mm-hmm. what I would do for the summer is, since I got young kids, I would either book the Montreal Comedy Festival and take my family with me, or I would do Australia and I would take the family. Again, like I would do a month in Australia. I would do like 6 shows over a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have nights off to go here and there.
By the way, that's exactly what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing in February.
Yeah.
So, because, you know, so I don't have to be here in February because it's summer there.
Yeah. You go down there and you do like, so last time, I think it was summer of 2019 maybe, where we went and did Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Jakarta.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we did all 4 of those. Yeah. And it was great. It was a month and it was, you know, interspersed with shows, sightseeing, yada, yada. And then again, I gig then starting from September all the way to like mid-December, I would gig. And then take off mid-December to January, be with the family, do whatever I want.
Yeah.
So, you know, in between when I'm home, that January when I'm home, or December to January when I'm home, I'm not just sitting with my feet up.
Yeah.
I'm home for a couple of nights, but then I'm like, oh, you guys go to bed at 9:30 anyway. I'm going to the Comedy Store and the factory, and I'm doing, you know, 6 gigs a week.
Yeah,
working on material.
How long are your sets there when you're working on stuff?
15 to 20 minutes, you know, and so I'm constantly like, you know, it's like going to the gym, right?
Yeah.
You're constantly, and in doing that, you're coming up with newer and newer material. The best is when you've done a special. When you do a special, as you know, you're like, oh, great, my special came out. And they're like, oh, shit, I got to get rid of that
material. Everyone knows all my stuff. Yeah.
So the best is when you start that new tour and you're able to do an hour without using any of the old stuff. And you're like, ooh, this is coming together.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't need that killer bit. Because at the beginning, you're doing the killer bit.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, once that killer bit from the old special mm-hmm. works its way out.
But the new stuff, the killer bits start to materialize.
Yeah, now you start finding the new killer bits. Yeah. So, but you got to do it. You got to evolve. You know, I did bits about, you know, having a baby, right? And now that baby is 10 years old.
Yeah.
So I can't be like, oh,
but it's really funny. Honey, we're having another baby.
Yeah, exactly.
for the joke.
Bring back the joke.
So you are on the road I was on your website for people listening. MazJobrani.com. You have dates all the way up until November. Raleigh, New York City, Houston, Addison. So you go to places and then you're there for a few days.
Yeah. So the clubs I do, weekends at the clubs, and then I also intersperse some cities. I'll do a theater. So depending on where I am, it's either like a performing arts center or it's clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I'd love to be able to just do a theater tour. Mm-hmm. You know, but then when you go to the club, sometimes it's great too, because like I did the Irvine Improv 7 shows over the weekend. By the 7th show, you're like, oh, you know, you're flexing. You're like, got it.
Yeah, right.
You know? Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of it too, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm when this tour is over, I look forward to keep going. You know, I've done all this TV stuff.
Yeah.
But TV is just, as you know all too well, I'm sure, it's just so unpredictable and it's uncontrollable by you.
Yeah.
Things are great. The show's great. I've been in that situation. Dude, your show, like my show, Three Sheets, number one show on the network. And the guy called me, the owner of the network, is like, hey, just so you know, good news and bad news. Oh, okay. Well, your show is the number one show on the network. In fact, more people knew about your show than the network that it was on. Which brings me to the bad news, is that the network's going off the air in 2 weeks.
Which network was that?
It was called Mojo.
Okay.
It was one of the first HD networks. And it was great. And everyone who got an HD set from like 2007 to 2009 had four channels, and Mojo was one of them.
Wow.
And so everyone who got an HD set saw it, which was a great way to sort of, you know, launch that. But, well, I was always saying I'm going to do my stand-up tour because no one can come in and cancel that except God.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have said it. Shouldn't have said it
He did. And he did it.
Yeah.
And he did it.
He,
yeah.
She?
She, it,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The way it happened, it felt like a she.
Well,
I'm not
it's
saying
a, it's
that
a God in
way.
A lab, I think, now.
Yes.
Right? Is
yes.
that what it is?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. God by committee.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, listen, it was amazing meeting you. I want to do it again because I have a lot more questions for you.
Yeah.
So maybe in a month or so,
definitely.
Come back.
And start coming to the clubs, man. You're gonna enjoy it.
Done. Yeah. Done. Do it. As long as you heckle me.
I will. I'll be there.